The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, a special edition, December 6th, 2018. I had originally asked Preet Bharara to come on the Lawfare Podcast to discuss the report of the National Task Force on Rule of Law and Democracy, which he co-chairs with former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman. And we did talk about that, but along the way, we talked about a bunch of other things, too, because there's been a lot in the news, people. Just as we were about to start recording, the Washington Post reported that the president was considering nominating former Attorney General William Barr to take over his old job once again. There's been a bunch of special counsel news. And so we got to talking, and before we knew it, it was not one of those podcasts that would wait its turn. It was just kind of a special edition of the Lawfare podcast, so we're putting it out there same day. So here it is, folks. It's the Lawfare podcast, episode 371. Preet Bharara discusses everything. So Preet, I invited you on the podcast to talk about the National Task Force Rule of Law and Democracy Proposal for Reform report. But since you agreed to do it and we've scheduled it, a whole lot of news has broken. And it seems crazy to have you on and not talk about any of that. So as we were getting ready to start recording, the Washington Post reported that the president is inclined to nominate Bill Barr, that's former Attorney General Bill Barr, to be Attorney General again. And let's start there. What do you make of Bill Barr?
So I don't know him personally very well. By the way, thanks for having me on the show. And it seemed inevitable that no matter what plan one has these days to talk about a particular topic, that there would be news that would overwhelm that. So happy to talk about the new stuff. So my great concern has been with respect to any significant appointment by this president, given his state of agitation, given the anger he has about the Mueller investigation, given all the evidence that he wants to shut it down, given his seeming happiness with Matt Whitaker, who I think a lot of people think is not qualified and it was not a proper appointment, that we would get some, you know, super partisan, also unqualified hack for the position. So insofar as people are suggesting someone like Bill Barr is the leading candidate, which I don't necessarily believe, I'm at least comforted, and not everyone will love this, I'm at least comforted that he is, based on my personal experience and based on reputation, you know, a real lawyer, a serious, thoughtful person who may have particular ideological views, but he's, you know, I don't think people think of him as somebody who can't do the job. In fact, he did the job once upon a time, a long time ago. And, you know, literally when I saw the report, I had to go back and remind myself, I thought to myself, he must be 110 because he had the job, you know, during the time that the person we've been commemorating last week, George H.W. Bush, was president. It turns out he was very, very young.
He was a very young AG, and his assistant attorney general for the criminal division was one Bob Mueller, if memory serves.
Correct. With whom I would believe there's a respectful relationship, not that there always is, between the AG and the assistant attorney general of the criminal division. So look, and he's had serious jobs in private practice as well. I dealt with him for a period of time when I was a staffer in the Senate, and he was at Verizon over, you know, various bits of pending legislation, and I found him to be thoughtful and smart. And I know we have the, no pun not intended, that the bar is pretty low these days, but I would prefer somebody who has a reputation for being thoughtful and a real lawyer, someone who has some understanding of the institution of that place, which Bill Barr certainly does. I mean, are there better people that I would be happier with? Sure. But there also are a lot worse people that I think would be much more interested in a political agenda and personal loyalty of the president that we would be more unhappy about. So, you know, I don't know what your thoughts are. I think you tweeted about it a little while ago. But if we're talking about people like Bill Barr, I feel less concerned than I did before.
Yeah, that's almost exactly what I tweeted. I mean, Barr has apparently said some less than savory stuff over the last couple of years, both in interviews and in things that he's written on, you know, that I think should legitimately be a matter of concern and inquiry. On the other hand, he's somebody who has, you know, run the Justice Department, worked with, you know, knows super, in which capacity, by the way, if memory serves, he supervised two special counsel investigations. This was in the period in which the independent counsel law had lapsed. And so he has some experience with this. He has worked with Mueller, and he is somebody who has, you know, knows the values and traditions of the department. And I think that given that we've been, the people we've been talking about have been, you know, Judge Jeanine and Rudy Giuliani and, you know, like
and Chris Kobach.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the idea that we could have somebody who had served as attorney general in the first Bush administration supervising the Mueller investigation, that would be a relatively decent outcome, honestly.
Look, at this point, I think, given how many people there are, you mentioned some of them, who would be terrible for the department, who don't appreciate the principles and the institutions that are important to the rule of law, getting somebody who, you know, at least has demonstrated some ability to color within the lines, knows the institution, has been at the helm of it before, is better than we could otherwise get. Now, you know, I haven't seen some of the things that Bill Barr has said over the last couple of years, which may cause me to rethink my thoughts about these things. But, you know, among the list of people, we could do a lot worse, as I said. And look, occasionally, Donald Trump, even though if he had his personal druthers, would pick people who, you know, would swear some blood oath of loyalty to him, occasionally he picks people who are considered, I think, above board and straight arrows. I think we got lucky in that regard with respect to Chris Wray. There were lots of names being bandied about, some more political than others. And, you know, based again on reputation, and although I have some criticisms based generally on his performance at the top of the FBI, Chris Wray has been a professional and has been good for that bureau. And if we could get lucky enough to have, in all the swirling controversy and concerns about the demolishing of a legitimate ongoing investigation, maybe Bill Maher is okay. And the last thing I would say is, and maybe I'm repeating myself, is, you know, sometimes it's good to have people in office who do care about their own reputation among lawyers. And Bill Barr has nothing really to prove. He's been in the job before. And sometimes you get, you know, a return office holder who's been in that spot before. I mean, we saw that when I was in the Senate, when George W. Bush brought back, now I'm forgetting his name, the White House counsel.
Fred Fielding.
Yeah, I was going to say Fred Friendly, but that was not it. He brought back Fred Fielding, who had had the job before. And there is something about the gravitas of such a person who I think would also improve the morale of the place that we can be a little bit happy about. But look, you know, my view is we should be so lucky as to get somebody like Bill Barr. And I know some people are not going to agree with that because they think, you know, I think a lot of people on the left think they will get or should deserve somebody, you know, that Hillary Clinton would have appointed, and that's just not going to happen.
Well, I mean, I think the dream, the reasonable dream for somebody in the center or left would not be for somebody Hillary Clinton would have appointed, but for somebody Richard Nixon would have appointed, right? That there are these points of pressure in an administration where the reasonable response of the administration, the administration kind of gets backed into appointing an Elliot Richardson or somebody who is sort of genuinely above politics, right? Gerald Ford naming Ed Levy, right? These figures who are so above politics that there's simply no question as to their integrity. Of course, it didn't work out that well with Elliot Richardson, except in the sense that Elliot Richardson behaved exactly as the way one would have expected Elliot Richardson to behave. And I don't think Bob Barr is in that category. Bill Barr. I don't think he's in that category. On the other hand, I do think he is somebody who is a professional, as you say, is somebody who has a reputation as a lawyer to uphold, and from my point of view, most importantly, is somebody who has some intimacy at the senior management level with how the Justice Department does and does not behave.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And again, I don't know him personally well, and haven't dealt with him professionally or otherwise in a number of years. But I think the thing that matters the most, you know, like it does in the Senate, like it does in the House, like it does throughout the cabinet, is picking somebody, conservative, Republican, fine, but somebody who puts, you know, certain institutions and principles above partisanship. And, you know, to get someone like Bill Barr as opposed to a Kris Kobach would be really, I think, important. Or even Lindsey Graham, for that matter. I think at this point it'd be better not to have a politician. And another name, I don't know how high it is on the list, someone who I'm much more personally familiar with, who I think is at the same firm, in fact, as Bill Barr, is Mark Philip, who also served as the Deputy Attorney General, also served as a federal judge, also served as a federal prosecutor, who's a bit younger, and who I know to be somebody who cares about, you know, the traditions of that place, and by that I mean the good traditions of the place, in sort of a Chris Wray-like manner.
Yep.
And so we should all be hoping for somebody who cares about the law because the law is important, as opposed to politics, or as opposed to pleasing somebody who's at the top of the food chain in the form of the president. That's what's important. I mean, I don't know that I believe that Bill Barr or anyone else is going to be nominated anytime soon, but I guess we'll see.
So let's talk about three people who care very deeply about the law in somewhat the opposite way than we're talking about now, which is to say Paul Manafort, Michael yeah. Cohen, and Michael Flynn. It's been quite a week of action in special counsel land, and I'm interested in your gestalt sense of where we are, particularly set against this Mike Isikoff story that I think a lot of people are misinterpreting, that the special counsel is, you know, in winding down mode. So how should we understand it? Are we in winding down mode? And what does, and if so, what does a wind down that looks like this sequence of events signify?
So those are great questions and multiplicitous. Look, I want to begin, as always, when I talk about these things, to say I don't really know. And I don't like to predict, and I think there are versions of events that could happen one way, that some people reasonably have cause to say it will unfold in a particular way, and also reasonable cause to say it will unfold in a different way. I'll give you one example of why I'm cautious and hesitant to make predictions and describe what's going on behind the scenes, because nobody really knows. There's this issue, the last person you mentioned, Michael Flynn, who pled guilty over a year ago. We've now seen one sentencing submission on the part of the government. I kept trying to see if I could read through the redaction, because sometimes people make that mistake, but I assume the special counsel's office is better at that. But every once in a while, people use a marker that's not dark enough. And the question that I have had, and other people who have had my position have had, who have a lot of experience among us, is why is Michael Flynn being sentenced so soon when the matters about which he has given information are still not only ongoing, but are so sensitive that information relating to that has to be redacted from this public document. And no one quite understands why that is. There was a lot of controversy, as you'll remember, in the interpretations over what the Michael Flynn plea meant last year. I had one view. Not everyone agreed with that view. But the norms of how you predict things will unfold with respect to a normal case that I might have overseen as a United States attorney or somebody might have overseen out of Maine Justice, those rules don't seem to apply. And it seems that something, with the special counsel is we don't really know. I tend to think, going back to the thrust of your question, that we are more likely not in a wind down than in a more sprawling situation. The fact that there is all this redaction in the Michael Flynn sentencing memorandum, which looks like it's dealing with a number of matters and including a matter or two that we don't even know exists or we don't have a lot of information about. You know, usually the way these things unfold is it takes a bit of time, to figure out who all the witnesses are, and then you go to other witnesses, and then they lead you to other folks, and then they lead you to other leads, and so on and so on. You know, I don't know, other than the wishful thinking on the part of some people who are close to the president and others who might be just weary of the news cycle, that we're entering anything like a slowdown or a wind-down period.
All right, I want to try to make a float a counter theory by you, in which there really is a wind-down going on, but it's a wind-down of a sort that is a bit different from what people would think when they read Isikoff's story. So Isikoff's story, first of all, Isikoff is a reporter I think very highly of. He has a track record of getting things right. So I take his reporting seriously and I take his sourcing at face value when he describes it, which is to say that he's talking to lawyers and people who are interfacing with the investigation, and they seem to think, and I don't believe he would report that if it were just the president's lawyers saying that, but people seem to think that they're in this mode of, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's. And from that, he infers that the investigation is in wind-down mode. Here is how I read that, which is that when Mueller's people say wind-down, what they mean is that the investigation, the scope of work of the investigation is known. They have a few I's to dot and T's to cross before they reach decision point on how to on what they are going to do with the fruits of the investigation, not that they are days or hours or even necessarily weeks away, but that they are, but that the scoping of the, you know, they're not in the phase anymore where they're still figuring out whole new avenues of investigation that they're looking at. Moreover, and this is why I think wind down can be a very slow process, they still have pending grand jury litigations, at least two in the D.C. Circuit that are, in one case, public, the Andrew Miller case, and in another case, semi-public, this mysterious right. Sealed case.
And there may be more to come. There are more things that can happen in connection with the litigation that may cause there to be other litigation to happen.
Not to mention, of course, that assuming they win on both of those points, and I'm certain they will win on the Andrew Miller question, the other one, I don't know what it is, but, the opposing litigants, whoever they are, get to go to the Supreme Court, which, you know, probably doesn't, I mean, the Miller question certainly isn't cert-worthy. I don't know what the other one is. But, so you could have weeks or months of litigation left there in order to dot or an I or cross a T. And then you have the question of what the decisions are that come at the end of this investigation. And those could be bringing new cases, a la Roger Stone, perhaps Jerome Corsi, right? Or it could be more in the realm of written work product, if you believe the sort of Mueller report theory. And so winding down has this sound of, well, the whole thing is petering out. My theory is, well, no, probably winding down means coming close to decision point, which could mean actually whatever degree of Armageddon the investigation portends for whomever it portends that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think all of that is perfectly reasonable. Part of the question, or part of the answer, depends on what we mean by the question, is the thing winding down, right? So if we're talking about an investigation winding down, when I oversaw investigations, you know, sometimes investigation would take a year, 2 years, 3 years. When we got close to the decision point, like you're describing, of charging someone, yeah, one way to talk about it is to say the investigation is winding down, and then the prosecution begins. That can still take a very long period of time because you have a charge, you have fighting of the charge, you have pre-motion, pre-trial practice, you have the trial itself. And then sometimes people flip after their charge, and that leads to other avenues of prosecution. So it's not a wind down in the sense that the case is winding down. The second point I would make is, you know, it is possible that some of what is in the sort of wheelhouse and the mainstream of what the Mueller folks are looking at in terms of investigation is winding down some, but that in part is because they have been parceling out parts of what they have looked at to other offices. And those sorts of things we have no reason to think are winding down. So, for example, you know, even other things related to the Cohen case that are at SDNY, we don't know all the things that are going on there. There has been reporting that some aspects of Flynn's cooperation with respect to his interactions and being paid by the government of Turkey are back with the Eastern District of Virginia. It wouldn't surprise me if that's far from being wound down. And it would also not surprise me if various aspects of what Mueller has been looking at and found evidence of has quietly been delivered to the National Security Division at Main Justice. And so they're running. So it's not just, you don't just have one quarterback in the form of Bob Mueller playing one game of football and advancing the ball to continue the metaphor down the field. He's actually passed other footballs to other people. And depending on where they are in their investigations or prosecutions, you could have all sorts of, you know, arteries going out that last a long time.
Right. So, I mean, he's been, you know, the you and I are old enough to remember when the conventional wisdom about special prosecutors, special counsels, independent counsels was that they hoarded jurisdiction. You know, that's the sort of rap on both Ken Starr and Lawrence Walsh.
Right. I mean, I felt that way as a U.S. attorney in the Southern District, too.
Right. And Mueller has behaved almost the opposite way. I mean, he seems to have shed responsibility for everything that isn't at the molten core of his jurisdiction, which is to say, if it's not about Russian intervention in the 2016 campaign, he's even shed stuff that's about Russian intervention in the 2018 campaign. If it's not about Russian intervention in the 2016 campaign or coordination with it on the U.S. side or obstruction of that investigation or Paul Manafort, he has all of which things are specifically detailed in the referral letter from Rod Rosenstein to him. He is not, does not appear to be investigating it. He appears to have given it to a Justice Department component other than himself, at least to the extent that those matters are public.
And the particular example of that, I think that is impressive, depending on your perspective, or odd, depending on your perspective, is how we handled Michael Cohen, right? Because at the start, I think a lot of people said when that case against Michael Cohen, the investigation against Michael Cohen, was parceled off to the Southern District of New York, my old office, some people speculated that means, well, Michael Cohen must not have anything interesting that Mueller believes that he has. And it was going to be solely the province of the Southern District of New York who did its business. And then here we find ourselves with information suggesting that Michael Cohen, of course, has cooperated with the Southern District. And even though he's going to be sentenced soon also, just like Michael Flynn, he has been providing information, you know, that goes at least somewhat to the molten core, as you call it, of the Mueller investigation. And a lot of people I know would not have made the decision with respect to this particular target to give it to somebody else if there was a reasonable and foreseeable chance that you as special counsel would have reason to be interacting with that target in the future as well. Like, why give it away a little bit when you're going to be taking it back a little bit later?
Right. And I think so. Let me bounce a theory of his behavior off of you and see if you buy it. seems to me he looked at this situation and said, I'm not going to make the Ken Starr mistake, which is to say to do a long investigation that amasses jurisdiction and makes me vulnerable to the charge of being sort of the president's personal prosecutor. I'm going to slough stuff off pretty consistently so that, number one, I'm not vulnerable to that charge. And also, number two, the president can't fire his way out of this situation because, unlike Ken Starr, I do not have the protections of the statute. Number two, I'm not going to make the Jim Comey mistake of speaking on behalf of the investigation. I'm actually going to force Rod Rosenstein to do that. So there's going to be the documents I file in court, but any statement that is made about the progress of the investigation is going to be made by the Deputy Attorney General, so that the Justice Department has to take institutional responsibility for everything that I do. And the result of this is an investigation that is quite lean jurisdictionally, that is really, not less vulnerable than people think it is to actions against individuals, because you would be a hell of a Saturday Night Massacre to fire half your former staff, the special counsel, and the Eastern District of Virginia, right? I mean, it's a pretty hard set of investigations and NSD. To get your hand, it's a pretty hard thing to get control over the degree of metastasis. And by the way, by not speaking at all, I'm going to preserve my moral authority and professional authority for the moment in which I have to speak on behalf of the investigation, because I'm not being able to conduct it appropriately.
A further point on your remark about how quiet Bob Mueller is, it's actually pretty astonishing as time goes by. I think it is probably not an overstatement to say that Robert Mueller in the last year and a half has been the most quiet, silent public prosecutor in the history of the world. And not only that, but the most quiet public figure who falls into the category of public figures who tend to stay away from microphones. And public comment, because they speak through their work, whether it's indictments or court opinions if you're a judge. And just look at the contrast between Bob Mueller and someone else who everyone knows in the country, Justice John Roberts. And John Roberts, and I give him credit for this in many ways, but he could not resist making a statement in support, I think, of his brother and sister judges around the country in the face of attacks by a president who doesn't seem to care much about the rule of law or about the institution of the judiciary, even knowing that he could speak one time, make one statement, and not get in the mud and continue to wrestle the president who likes to get in the mud, who has the power of the bullhorn of the presidency and the Twitter, the presidential Twitter account. Bob Mueller has never once decided, now maybe I should say something to stand up for the integrity of the department, even when he has been attacked personally, been accused of all sorts of conflicts and everything else. You can imagine somebody taking, not the 100% absolutist view of never speaking and uttering a word ever, but deciding strategically from time to time, to say something that's brief, like Justice Roberts did, and that might, bring up the morale of people around him, because nobody likes being attacked. Nobody likes their boss being attacked. And probably when all is said and done, the strategy of Bob Mueller, as you say, is the best one.
Do you think it's the best one? I mean, I look at it and I say it's
no other choice, I think.
So argue that out. I mean, I actually agree. I agree with you, I'm interested in hearing your line of thinking on that.
Yeah, and I don't feel this absolutely strongly. I think if I had been in Bob Mueller's position, it would have been very difficult for me every day, day after day, to keep silent and not issue some sort of, you know, even flat, high-minded, simple, straightforward defense of the integrity and the talents of the career people who are working with me, right? It actually takes a lot of strength to decide you're not going to do that. And the reason why I think ultimately, you know, there's no good position to be in because the president's going to be attacking you no matter what you do. But, you know, given the way that the president likes to engage in skirmishes and likes to attack and doesn't back down and wants the last word, you know, you adhere to the old adage, right? You never wrestle with a pig because, you know, you get dirty and the pig likes it. And even though I think some people probably around him wish he would issue statements from time to time, at the end of the day, it's probably the best option for him, because when he speaks, if he decides to speak, it probably would cause the president to speak even more and to attack even more. And once you make the decision after some periods of months, a period of months not to say anything, I guess it's just easier to be this sort of above the fray, silent person who just does his work. And it's hard to do something that's a hybrid of being like the quiet guy who speaks only through his work, but also occasionally, you know, responding to a barb. I don't know how you actually, you know, thread that needle.
Right. It has this other effect, which I think is, we have not seen the importance of, but I believe will be enormously important if and when the day comes, which is if Matt Whitaker tries to interfere with the investigation, tries to, you know, at the extreme case, tries to remove him or, you know, tries to do something that he feels he cannot tolerate and cannot negotiate with. The day that Bob Mueller speaks in public and holds a press conference, and people forget this, the key moment in Watergate, in the Saturday Night Massacre, was when Archibald Cox issues a statement and then sent Jim Doyle out to have a press conference about it after the firing. This was a huge moment in the sequence of events. The day Bob Mueller speaks is a very, very big day in the history of the Trump presidency. And
yes,
the reason it is that big a day is that he has reserved that capital so assiduously.
I wonder if people will be surprised to hear that he doesn't have a high voice like Jared Kushner.
Yeah, I think,
we,
you know,
hear speak very often.
I was at the FBI Agents Association dinner recently, and they showed a video in which all the recent former FBI directors are on the video, you know, talking about the FBI Agents Association and the work that it does on behalf of, you know, kids of fallen agents and what. It's actually an extremely moving video. I tweeted it for those who are interested. But one of the interesting things about it is, you know, the sound of Bob Mueller's voice, which a lot of people have never heard, right? And even though he was FBI director and he used to hold press conferences, people actually don't listen to that, you know? And so
that's right.
You know, I was sitting at,
he has a very nice voice. He would have a great career as a podcaster after FBI director.
And I'm sure you will have him on yours. And he's, of course, welcome on the Lawfare podcast. Preet, let's talk about your report, because I think
one thing to follow up on what you just said.
Yeah.
Are you positive that Bob Mueller will ever speak?
No, not at all.
But he may never speak.
I think the preference would be for him never to speak. That would be, I think that's his ideal, I think, at least based on behavior, is he will bring the cases he's going to bring in federal court and they will be announced by his supervisor, not by him. He will, under the reg, he's obliged to file some kind of a final report. He will do that and then he will vanish into the sunset and we'll never hear from him again. I think that's his ideal, don't you?
I think so. Although the next moment that he has a big announcement to make that is worthy of a press conference, is that going to be Matt Whitaker or is that going to be Rod Rosenstein?
I don't know. I mean, I still don't understand who's supervising the investigation at this stage. There's all this reporting that at a day-to-day level, it's still Rod Rosenstein. It's also, you know, Whitaker certainly doesn't seem to have recused. But that's not
so odd to me at all, because in normal institutions, so I was the United States Attorney, I had a deputy United States Attorney. I recused from one matter in my whole time there, but for everything else, depending on the circumstances, there were other people up to and including my deputy who were engaged in the day-to-day monitoring and supervising of the matter. And from time to time, it was important enough that I was involved in every important decision. Sometimes I was not involved in some decisions. And sometimes we talked about it in a group setting. And it would seem, you know, more terrible than I think people appreciate if Whitaker came in, and just because he comes in over Rod Rosenstein, that for Rod to be relieved of his duties, given the continuity issues and given his institutional knowledge of the pace of the investigation and the content of the investigation, that he would be removed completely. This seems to be the more, you know, logical way to do it. Obviously, I and others, you know, believe that he should recuse himself, but at a minimum, it gives me some comfort if it's true, as you say, has been reported, that Rod Rosenstein is still sort of in command, except he's just no longer the final word.
I would assume that would be, since, I mean, I obviously don't need to tell you this, but listeners may not know that the normal day-to-day operations of the Justice Department are run by the Deputy Attorney General, not the Attorney General. And
yes,
the Deputy's office is much larger than the Attorney's office, the Attorney General's office. And as a general matter, the octopus's arms that actually manage the department are the Associate Deputy Attorney Generals feeding the deputy, who then feeds the Attorney General's office. And so my assumption is that if Whitaker is ultimately not recused, the day-to-day management of the Mueller investigation would still be under the deputy, and that you would have the acting attorney general function for purposes of the Russia investigation migrate up to the acting attorney general, but the deputy attorney general function with respect to the Russia investigation would continue to reside with Rod. Do you think that's likely right?
Look, I think that's the best course, and that's how it should work. And it probably is good for Matt Whitaker also, because to come in, like a lot of people assume, that his coming in at a higher level means that Rod is sort of taken out of the chain of command, is not good for him. I think to the extent Matt Whitaker wants to do anything, even if it's nefarious, it is much better for him to figure out a way to do it through a chain of command that includes Rod Rosenstein than for him to be having, you know, Bob Mueller himself in the acting AG's office saying, do this or don't do that. That's terrible for him. It's terrible from a substantive perspective. It's terrible from a process perspective. And it's terrible ultimately when it comes out through oversight from an optics perspective.
Right. All right. This time for real, let's shift to your task force report. Tell us about the National Task Force on the Rule of Law and Democracy, which is this side project that you did while we were all listening to your podcasts.
I've had a few side projects, including just finished writing a book.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
So one of the things that happened when I came to the faculty at NYU Law School was talking to Michael Waldman, who's the head of the Brennan Center and does a lot of great work in so many areas, as you know, is what we care about in this country. And some of the things that I've been concerned about was that every day there's a news cycle, and every week there's 10 news cycles. And the things that people are responding to are sort of just in the moment. And there should be a role for people on a bipartisan basis who are upset about the way institutions are being undermined, whether it's the press or the Congress or the separation between politics and law enforcement or ethics enforcement, you name it, that it was important for people in a bipartisan way to think longer term about what kinds of things that have been done on an honor basis, in other words, based on traditional norms, which of those things, in light of recent events and even events that happened over the years, should our Congress think about codifying into a hard law? Because that's happened over time. It's not just recently. And
so what are some examples? Let's pause there. What are some examples of that, norms that we've eventually codified into hard law?
So my favorite one goes back to the beginning of the Republic, which we talked about in the report to sort of orient people as to how this is a time-honored tradition in this country. Yet George Washington, which everyone remembers, decided after two terms as president, he didn't want to run for a third term, and nothing prevented him from doing so because he didn't want to become a king. And after that, everyone who came after him, agreed with that norm. Some were defeated and couldn't have run again, but along comes someone who was very popular president, FDR, in the middle of the last century. And he's like, look, I got elected three times. Then he got elected four times. And the reason it's a good example is, A, everyone knows it, and B, that's an instance of a president who is enormously popular, and many people would tell you is one of the reasons why we don't speak German or Japanese, and we still have our freedom. And even so, even though it was a very popular president, maybe one of the greatest presidents this country will ever see, notwithstanding some flaws, we did the most difficult thing you can do in our system. We amended the Constitution. You know, a similar thing happened after John Kennedy nominated his president, Bobby, to be the AG. You know, a lot of people think Bobby Kennedy was actually a very good attorney general. I happen to think he was. Flawed also, but a good attorney general. And what did people do? Even though there was a revered, assassinated president, who had as his AG, in many ways a revered and also assassinated attorney general, we still changed the law, the nepotism law, so that can happen. So part of what we're focused on is not just what Trump has done, but to make sure that we think thoughtfully about the ways in which we can tighten up some of the rules, make them more clear. You can't do this with everything, but some things you can, to prevent the next person from coming along, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, a conservative or a liberal, to not be able to say, hey, look, the last guy, Donald Trump, got away with not divesting his interests. He got away with not disclosing his tax returns. He got away with pardoning his associates. So I can do that too. So somewhere you got to draw the line.
All right. So you draw a bunch of lines and you've grouped them, broadly speaking, into two broad categories. One is sort of ethics and government, and the other is what you call the rule of law and even-handed administration of justice. I think I would call it sort of, you know, the principle of apolitical law enforcement. So let's talk about ethics and government first. It's less germane to the subjects that Lawfare deals with, so we'll deal with it relatively briefly to focus on the other one. But what are the major set of recommendations here?
So some of them. So we had to sort of thread the needle between trying to be somewhat specific, but also not being so specific that we set forth the languages, textual language for members of Congress to adopt. So there could be some flexibility. So among other things, we talk about, as I've already mentioned, the disclosure of tax returns if you plan to run for president or vice president of the United States, a way in which we could beef up the Office of Government Ethics so they actually have some teeth, do something to streamline and also make more relevant and provide more transparency with respect to disclosures about people's finances if you're in public office. You know, with respect to that, for example, some of your listeners, whether or not they focus on the ethics issues or have been in and out of government, in some ways the disclosure requirements are too broad and, you know, too onerous and in some ways not onerous enough. So part of what we have proposed is having, you know, a further group of people who are experts to finally take a hacking saw, you know, to the form SF-278, not to get too much in the weeds, to make sure that the public has the information that it needs to have to find out if there are conflicts of interest. We also think there are ways in which Congress can do things to make sure that there's actually some teeth in the emoluments clause. In this past week, there has been reporting about how the Saudis rented out, I think, 500 rooms at Trump locations and were treated in all sorts of generous ways by the Trump organization. We've also proposed a way to figure out in a way that's not onerous to the duties of the President of the United States to keep the country safe, to subject both the Vice President and the President to a lot of the same conflict of interest rules and laws that other people like me, as U.S. attorney, were subjected to. So it's a broad set of proposals that seek to prevent some of the bad things we see going on, allow people who are in office some flexibility to adopt, you know, the best way and the best compromise to accomplish it, and brought into a report in a bipartisan way. As you mentioned, my co-chair is Christy Todd Whitman, who's the former governor of New Jersey, Republican, a Republican cabinet member for George W. Bush. We have former Governor Mike Castle, who's a Republican. We have David Iglesias, who's a former Republican United States attorney. Out west, we have Don Verrilli, who you know, who's a former Solicitor General under Barack Obama. So it's a group of people, all of whom have been in office, who care about ethics, and also the second issue we're going to talk about, the apolitical enforcement of the law.
So before we turn to that, I want to ask you about one reform that is not listed in your government accountability and ethical conduct section, but which I was a little surprised not to find it there, and I was wondering whether you guys considered it. One of the things that I found, I've always known, but in the last couple of years have found very frustrating, is that the Freedom of Information Act does not apply to the executive office of the president. And it applies only to agencies, which, as with the anti-nepotism laws and whatnot, is, you know, defined in such a way, at least in case law, to exclude the White House itself. And I'm interested in whether you guys considered the question of application of FOIA to the White House and rejected it, or whether it just kind of never came up.
So I should make another thing clear. So this was our first report that we wanted to get out before the midterm elections. We had lots of discussion about all sorts of other things that we want to talk about next, including money and politics, including transparency issues. And, you know, I think we touched upon the FOIA issue. We also talked about civic education, all sorts of things that were not possible to accomplish and reach agreement on in the few months that we've been working in the last year. So, you know, I will take that back to the task force as we talk about the next set of things that we want to talk about. But I agree with you that that's a problem. It was not considered and rejected. It was considered briefly and may find its way into a future report.
I see. All right, let's talk about even-handed administration of justice. So this is an area where I don't think we need to spend time articulating the problem that the last couple of years has presented. But I do want to start with a basic question. Do you think that there is a problem that predates the last couple of years? Every administration, I used to joke that every attorney general gets called the most political attorney general in history. I kind of hit the snooze button whenever I hear people saying that, at least until now. And all administrations get accused of, like, going after their political enemies, and the allegation is almost always nonsense, whether it's, you know, we have in this administration seen the president very openly calling for that exact thing to happen. And so my question is, what's new here and what's not new here?
Yeah, so I will say that you're right to point out, and we do point out in the report, with respect to pretty much everything that we say needs some reform attention, that there are analogs in the past. You know, whether you talk about the pardon power, there were bad pardons issued by President Clinton. Whether you talk about the issue we're currently on, and that is a bleeding of, you know, politics and law enforcement, that clearly has happened before. In fact, what I cut my teeth on when I was chief counsel to Senator Schumer back in 2007 was an investigation, a bipartisan investigation by the Senate Judiciary Committee into this kind of politicization of the Justice Department, including the firing of U.S. attorneys, somewhat ironically,
including your co-panelist Iglesias.
That is correct, David Iglesias. That's how I got to know him. And one of the issues that came up was precisely this: the lowering of the wall between people who are political officials in the White House and people who are responsible for enforcement of specific actions against specific individuals. Like, obviously, your audience knows better than anyone that obviously the people in the White House need to talk to people in law enforcement, including the FBI director, the deputy attorney general, the attorney general, about threats to the country to maintain national security interests. But when it comes to specific prosecutions against specific people and enforcement actions, the White House is supposed to stay the hell out of it. So there was a back and forth. There were new guidelines that were issued. They get revised from time to time. It was, in fact, those protocols about contact between the White House and members of the Justice Department that I consulted in March of 2017 when the president called me and left a message, and I decided not to call him back and was relieved of my duties, 48 hours later. So, yes, it is true that these kinds of issues come up. They've all come up before. But like everything else with this president, they come up with, to a degree and in a kind that's far in excess of anything that's ever happened before. And it's, you can see this in parallel in lots of different areas, right? Lots of presidents have had a contentious relationship with the press and they complain about the press. Donald Trump takes it to new levels. And the same here. No one on our task force has ever seen an occasion where you have the actual sitting president with the bullhorn that he has, basically calling for the investigation and jailing of his political adversaries. When this issue has come up before, it's been at sort of a different level, lower down in the White House or lower down in the Justice Department. But it remains a problem, and that's why, there's a bipartisan group of folks who are saying maybe we should do more about it.
All right, so what do you propose to do? Let's walk through the specific recommendations here.
So look, let me say as a caveat to all of this, nothing we think is a panacea. Norms are norms for a reason. You can't over-legislate everything. You have to count on people to exercise their discretion wisely. And so part of what we advocate is for there to be accountability through transparency. So among the things we're proposing with respect to contacts between political officials and law enforcement officials is A, the publishing of a contacts policy, so everyone knows what that contacts policy is supposed to be, a maintenance of logs of contacts with respect to specific enforcement matters, and without getting, again, too much in the weeds, reports mandated on a regular basis between an administration and the Congress so they can take a look and see if there's something untoward and engage in oversight hearings, if that makes any sense. Also, something with respect to the special counsel that you've seen various members of Congress propose. It's an issue on which Jeff Flake has decided not to vote on any additional judges nominated by Donald Trump, but protection of a special counsel who can only be removed for cause. To have agency inspectors general have the ability to investigate interference with enforcement matters. None of these is going to solve the problem, and you're always going to have this tension between people wanting to protect their own and sort of push the envelope and the line of what is getting involved in policy versus what is getting involved in a specific enforcement matter. But we think these things would be helpful.
All right. I want to pose one more question and then I'll let you go. It seems to me as I read these and, each of them is a subject that could, support a pretty robust discussion. But it seems to me when I read these, as you say, none of them is going to really solve the problem, and that the fundamental problem here can only be addressed by congressional will. That is, if you pass all this stuff and Congress isn't willing to stand up to a president who wants to get inappropriately involved in law enforcement pending matters and isn't willing to say to them, if you do that, we will take it out of your hide, either in the form of impeachment or in the form of, appropriations to things you care about, or in some other way, we will exact a very powerful price for not keeping your hands off things where they don't belong. No amount of norm enshrining in statute is going to substitute for that. And maybe if you do those, if Congress is willing to play that role, you don't need some of this stuff. And so I guess I want to close with the question, how much can enshrining norms in statute in fact substitute for, ongoing, robust separation of powers headbutting.
Yeah, look, I completely agree with that. That you know, for justice to be done, you have to have good people who understand their oversight function, who understand that they're not supposed to be supine if you're in the legislative branch. And, you know, if you have a few people who decide to impose a few more rules that can be observed in the breach, you're not going to solve the problem. It does depend a little bit on which issue you're talking about. So, for example, if you enshrine the norm that someone who's running for president has to disclose his tax returns, that's a little difficult to get around. And if that's the law, that's the law. And I think that can have, you know, a robust and helpful impact. But I'll give you another example that exactly crystallizes the point and concern that you're talking about, because there's a limit to what you can enshrine. I believe that the president, you know, is poised to abuse his pardon power, but he has very broad discretion and authority on how to exercise it. And there's a, you know, even some debate on the self-pardon. And we've suggested, we had some internal debate about it, should we comment on it at all, given that there's not much you can do short of a constitutional amendment? And we have a modest proposal, which is to require the president, in connection with a hypothetical pardon of someone who is close to him, either a member of a family, of his family, or a business associate, to provide a written justification for that pardon. And the reasonable debate is, well, what the hell does that do? It doesn't do a whole lot, because you can pardon the person in any event. And the hope was, which I think goes to your point, is that the more you obligate a president to say what he's doing and why, that in the face of a truly egregious pardon, that might, and maybe this is overly optimistic, idealistic, and hopeful, that you would have people in Congress do the thing that you're describing. That if you have to put it in their face that this is a nonsensical, pretextual basis for pardoning Paul Manafort or Michael Cohen or anyone else you might mention, given that there's a requirement to provide a written explanation, that might cause a supine Congress to wake up. And these are little things. In the aggregate, I think they make a difference. But there is no substitute for each actor in each branch, whether it's the courts, the Congress, or the president, to do their job.
I would just close by saying that the act of enshrining these, or some of them, or considering them in a serious way, is probably more important than the substance of what any one of them will do. That is, a Congress willing to, I actually think there are constitutional problems with the Mueller protection bill, but I do think it's really, really important that Congress show willingness to protect Mueller, not because the bill itself is going to do very much, but because the congressional pushback itself is a sign of resolve that may be a deterrent. And so I just think that considering what we can do as a legislative matter is actually part of doing it.
I agree with that. And, you know, in the same way, it's sort of a form of modest protest on the part of a group of people who used to be in government to raise awareness of something and hope that members of Congress, like you say, will show the president that certain kinds of behavior will exact a cost.
Preet Bharara, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Ben Wittes, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. We don't have music on the special editions of the Lawfare podcast, but if we did, it would be performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer this week is the long-suffering Michaela Fogel, who heroically put this podcast together. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And of course, you need to do your part in promoting the Lawfare podcast. So, tweet it, share it, talk about it at dinner parties, all the usual things. And if you're one of those people who I suspect may listen to the Lawfare podcast for the first time because you're a listener of Preet Bharara's podcast, welcome. And check out some of the other episodes. We do this twice a week, and we have a lot of fun with it. And of course, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.